You'll go to Isaiah 9, going to be there today. Like, this is the week, the Sunday before Christmas is like one of my favorite times to teach and preach. It's just so many cool texts you can go to. And we decided to go to this one this year. There's just something about the birth of Jesus and the hope that his incarnation brings. It just seems to lighten the burdens of life maybe just a little bit. There's something, it's just good. It's good to just sit and remember the story. We love to hear the story of Christmas. We love the story of the little baby in the manger, and the shepherds, and the star, and the angels, and the animals, and the wise men, and all that. It's just awesome. It's a wonderful story. And we're going to take a second and look at this. Really, it's a prophecy from Isaiah in chapter 9. Let's get a little bit of backdrop to what's happening before we jump into chapter 9. Because it's just so important. And again, as I was studying this, I kept having to go back and back and back and back, and then finally find a place where we can just sort of start today and get an idea before we get to chapter 9. Otherwise, we miss the entire point of this passage, which is actually really, really, really good. So leading up to this chapter, what is happening in the life of the Israelite nation is this. The Assyrians had come in and they had conquered the Israelites. And we can read these things in the previous chapters. They displaced the Israelites from their land. And so God has sent the prophet Isaiah. He commissions him to go and to confront the wicked king. His name was King Ahaz. He's the worst. He's the worst. Ahaz is like the worst. One of the worst kings ever in all of Scripture. He hated God. He constructed this is maybe his most heinous thing that he did, among other things. He constructed this idol to the Ammonite, the Canaanite god Molech. And he constructed it outside the city of Jerusalem where the worship of this pagan god, this pagan idol would take place. And there's, as you study out this god, this pagan entity of Molech, there's a little bit of debate on what it means. And he's typically pictured, this idol is typically pictured as like a lower half of a man and the top half of like a bull, so like this big cow face and horns, almost like a minotaur kind of thing. And he sits there and he's on his throne and his arms are usually outstretched, something like this. And some would say that the god Molech, or the name Molech, means king, specifically king of the underworld. Others would say that the word Molech, at least in the Hebrew, is just MLK. There's no vowels. And so it looks like the word milk. And people say that it means the word milk. But the idea is that there are sacrifices to this god, and he is holding his arms out, receiving the sacrifice. And the idea of a milk sacrifice came along. The idea of child sacrifice. So what is clear, among all of the debate and the scholarly stuff that goes along, what is clear is that no one has anything good to say about this god Molech and the worship and the practices involving worship him. They are evil, they are wicked, they are dark, they are satanic. And that is uniformly agreed upon. And so King Ahaz has come along and he has forsaken the God of Israel, and he has fully embraced the worship of this god Molech. So much so that he constructed a furnace at the feet of the idol where the parents would be forced to bring their children, and the children, it says, they would pass through the fire as the children were offered as a sacrifice to appease this pagan god. Ahaz, beyond that, he closed down the temple in Jerusalem and demanded that the Israelite God be abandoned forever in favor of these other gods that King Ahaz himself chose. And then the last verse of chapter 8 in Isaiah, it just describes the earth being filled with distress, darkness, gloom, and anguish. It says, and they will look to the earth, but behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. And imagine, you know, you being maybe just a typical Jewish family living in the city or around the city at that time, and you've been taken over by these Assyrians, and there's this wicked king, and he's doing all this, and he's forbidding you from worshiping your God, and taking your children and offering them as a sacrifice to this false god. The idea of living in darkness and gloom and anguish certainly would be an apt description of that situation. Then we come to chapter 9. And chapter 9 begins with a promise. And if we don't understand all of those preceding ideas and facts that lead up to chapter 9, we miss all of chapter 9. And yet, how many times do we start in chapter 9? Well, oh, and there's like a whole song. For unto us a child is born, for, right? Like, it's a whole thing. And we start there, but like, that phrase specifically, I'm going to get to that in a second, but it means so much more than just, hey, there's a baby in a manger. We have to understand the backdrop. The beginning of chapter 9, it begins with a promise, and it promises to turn the tide. It says, there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In other words, the darkness and despair will not last forever. It will come to an end. And then the rest of chapter 9 and verse 1, it describes this very specific part of the region of Galilee. It's Naphtali and Zebulun. They are sons of Jacob, and they become two of the 12 tribes of Israel. And Joshua 19 records all of this, that the land in the northeastern part of Galilee, this land that is being described here in chapter 9 of Isaiah and verse 1, was given to these two tribes. And it specifically describes in verse 1 of chapter 9, Galilee of the nations. The idea of Galilee of the nations is the Gentile land of Galilee. It was a derogatory idea due to the proximity of this northeastern part of Galilee to the Gentile nations that lived to the north. And the easy passageway, this area of Galilee, this area of these two tribes, were seen as like the gateway to the Gentiles coming in and mixing in with the Jewish people and intermarrying and doing all these things and bringing in their false gods. It was not a place that was looked on like, yay, you live in northeastern Galilee. It's like, oh, okay. It's like, I don't know, I grew up in Lakeland. I grew up in Polk County. So if you see any like Florida man stuff on the news, guarantee it's from Polk County. Like that's where I grew up in. And I grew up on like the northeast side, the wrong side of the tracks. I grew up in Kathleen, Florida. And so when I tell somebody that is from Polk County, where'd you grow up? Oh, I grew up on like the south side. Oh, that's nice. It's like, oh, I grew up in Kathleen. It's like, ooh, like that's rough. That's this. Nobody wants to go there. You'd be like, hey, I'm moving on up. I made it. I came up. I'm moving to Kathleen, Florida. That's not it. Hey, man, you came up. You're moving to northeastern Galilee. It's the opposite of that. It is the home of these two tribes, but now it has been overrun by these pagan nations and their pagan worship. And so the idea in these previous chapters, the end of chapter 8 and even the beginning of chapter 9, is that it seems like God has turned his back on the land and in its people, but in the beginning of this first verse of chapter 9, we have this wonderful promise that God would not allow this land to be spiritually desolate forever. He would make this land, but he's talking specifically about this northeastern back part of Galilee. I will make this land special. I will make this land have a glorious heritage. So the backdrop, to summarize all of that, coming to chapter 9 of Isaiah, is this. The world exists in darkness. Evil has produced all kinds of terrible acts as mankind has rejected their creator God in favor of false gods. The chastisement of God is upon his rebellious people, and he allows them to experience the consequences of their rebellion and to live in darkness, but not forever. There would come a day when darkness would be overtaken. And what is the one energy that can dispel darkness? It's light. As Jackie read Isaiah 9:2, let's just look at that again down to verse 5. It says, the people, these people who have lived and walked, it says, in darkness, have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as one with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the trampling warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. Light, it says, has come. The darkness is pushed back. The people, it says, are restored. Joy has returned. Joy like that of a great harvest when the people are sharing in the fruit of their labor. It says victory has come. The burdens are lifted. The rod of the oppressor is broken. The attire of war is destroyed, and peace shall reign. That's the promise of these first few verses. Look, the world is a disaster because of sin and evil, but there is coming a day when all of this will happen, and it says it's happening now. And it just says, I mean, the idea is like, okay, how? How? How is all of this going to go away? They're looking at this desolate place with its evil and its satanic worship and all of this, and they're experiencing this, and they're in anguish and darkness and turmoil, and they're like, We long for all of this to be better. We want the light to come. We want peace. We want that. How? How can this come? How can the evil and darkness and cruelty of the world be destroyed? What is this great illuminating energy that will do away with the darkness? And the answer is in verse 6, but it's not an energy. It's an entity. It's not a something, it's a someone. Then we come to that special part we love in verse 6. It says, for unto us a child is born. And we have to appreciate the fact that, you know, it's 2024, almost 2025. We know who the baby is. We know the hope that lies in the manger, that lives the perfect life that we cannot, that goes to the cross to pay the sin debt in full, that rises from the dead and gives us hope, that ascends and sends his spirit. We know all the rest of the story. These people didn't. They live in a world where babies are sacrificed on the altar of Moloch. And so when they hear, whoa, there's all this is going to happen, and there's a promise from God that there is deliverance and hope and freedom and life, and the brokenness of the oppressors is done away with, and the darkness is pushed back because a baby is going to be born. And you have to kind of, again, place yourself in that situation. It's like, what? What? Our hope is to be put in a baby? A baby is going to be the one who accomplishes all of this? We're supposed to be excited about a baby being born? Babies end up being thrown into the sacrificial fire around here. Don't you know that? So we have to appreciate the irony and the illustration that Isaiah is giving to us. The evil King Ahaz was sacrificing children to the pagan god Moloch. And God's prophet Isaiah is declaring that a baby is going to be born, bringing light, joy, blessing, victory, and peace. And so he describes how all of this will take place in the next set of verses. He just gives a few designations that I want to look at. He says, a child will be born to us. A baby will be born. And this, again, in and of itself is not significant, since babies were born all the time. The irony, as we mentioned, Isaiah is calling the people to find hope in the birth of a baby. Isaiah is calling the people to find hope in this baby that is going to be born because he is going to accomplish all of the things that he talks about in the next verses. This verse incidentally highlights the humanity of Jesus, born as a human being. A child will be born to us. Then it says, a son will be given to us. This baby that will be born is not simply a baby. It's to be a boy. It's to be a son. And the phrase, it almost sounds like it's the same thing. It just identifies the gender of the baby. It says, well, there's a baby that's going to be born, and the baby's going to be a boy. It's almost just kind of saying the same thing, but it's doing so much more than that. It's rather meant to designate the purpose for which the child, this son, will be born. The baby that is born is a gift. He is a gift to us. But now again, in and of itself, we would agree that all children are a gift from God. So okay, there's a child that's going to be born. That's not really special. It's going to be a boy, and like, children are a gift. Okay, great. Life is a gift. Life is God's to give, and it is God's to take. A son being given to us might be better communicated in this way. A child is going to be born to us. A son is going to be given for us. This baby that is born will be offered as a sacrifice. Now again, remember the context. The little baby is supposed to be the inspiration of hope to a people enslaved by this horrible king who worships this pagan god and sacrifices the people's children to him. So telling people that a baby boy will be born and will be offered as a sacrifice is not inspiring. It's like, that's already happening. But that's not the end of Isaiah's description, is it? And this is when these next phrases would have started to give the people a little bit of understanding of what Isaiah is going for. A child will be born to us. A son will be given, will be offered for us. But it says this child, this baby boy, will sit on the throne of David. And even the most simple-minded Jewish person would have recognized the significance of those words. The promise of the one who would sit on the throne of David would be the Messiah, the deliverer, the king. And it begins to describe that. It says, he will rule, this king who comes, this baby who is born will be a king. He will sit on the throne of David. He will rule with justice. He will rule with righteousness. This boy king would one day become the king and rule in fairness. He would rule in virtue. He would honor the one true God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He will rule with justice and righteousness. He will be different, so different. Then it just says that his reign will never end. And this, I think, is where it starts to get really good. And this is where the full comprehensive gospel is presented. This boy will be born. He will be a king. He will be a sacrifice. But the implication is that he will live and reign forever. If he is born and he is a king and then he is a sacrifice and dies, how is he going to reign forever? Oh, the resurrection is buried within this passage. This baby, this deliverer, this king, this Jesus would not be wrestled from his parents' hands and forcibly sacrificed at the feet of false gods, but he would voluntarily walk the hill of Calvary to die as a sacrifice for us. A son given for us. This baby would not pass through the fires of Moloch as a pagan sacrifice to honor evil and darkness. Jesus would instead pass through the fires of hell itself as he suffered the eternal punishment of sin, paying the debt in full. 3 days later, Jesus arose from the grave, having conquered sin and hell and now death. He emerges, bringing light, joy, blessing, victory, and peace, the very things that Isaiah promised would happen. The great light of the world had shone in the land of deep darkness, and now, with outstretched arms, Jesus offers forgiveness, restoration, life, and hope to anyone and everyone who will believe. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Understand how this mirrors what Isaiah is talking about. So that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but be granted everlasting life instead, because God didn't send his son again to be born as a baby to condemn the world. He sent his son to save it. In Isaiah, he continues by describing how this baby king will be referenced, how he will be remembered, what will be the legacy of this king. He lists names that are meant to conquer the evil perpetrated by King Ahab. It says this baby, this king that will sit on the throne of David and rule and reign forever in justice and fairness, he will be called Wonderful Counselor. A wonderful counselor to those who live in a broken world, to comfort them, to listen to them, to advise them. This baby, this king, will be called the Mighty God. He will bring comprehensive victory over all oppression. There's a line in the song of O Holy Night, it says, all oppression shall cease. He will be known as the everlasting Father to protect and provide for his family, to provide for his children. The Bible talks about those who are adopted into the family of God. It says no man or no entity can pull them out of his hand. There is no evil oppression that will come and snatch away the children of God. He will be called the Prince of Peace. He will establish a reign of never-ending harmony. And all these are the promises of Isaiah to these people that are living in this darkness and anguish, and they are to place their hope in this baby who is going to accomplish all of these things. But finally, verse 7 ends as Isaiah gives the ultimate reason we are to find hope in the baby who is to be born, the son who will be king and save and deliver us from darkness. Verse 7 ends as it makes this bold declaration. It says, the zeal of the Lord will do this. The zeal, or the determination, of the Lord, capital L-O-R-D, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the creator God of the universe, the most high God, he will bring this to pass. It is not simply something that is, you live in darkness and there's going to be this special baby is going to be born and one day he's going to do all this and just kind of trust us. It's like this is a guarantee, the promise of a baby being born that one day will redeem the world of darkness and bring about his own kingdom of light is a promise from God himself. God will do this. God will make it so. This is the story of Isaiah 9. It does not begin in chapter 9 and verse 6, for unto us a child is born. It begins back as we discover a world that exists in incomprehensible darkness. but there is a child that is born to us. And that baby will be given for us. It's the story of Isaiah. It's the story of Christmas. The world of darkness has seen a great light. We have a counselor. We have a mighty God. We have an everlasting Father. We have peace. We have someone to talk to, someone to worship, someone to love, because a child is born. And we're doing this Christmas service tonight, and in the very first song that we're going to sing contains the message of this passage that we've examined today. It's the message of the gospel. Joy to the world. The Lord has come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him room. And heaven and nature sing. The message of Isaiah 9 is the message of the gospel. It's the message of Christmas, the hope that is found in this baby. And it and as I read the lyrics to that song of making room for Jesus, let every heart prepare room for Jesus. It is our hope that the people in our community, the people in our church, would prepare room, would make room for Jesus in their heart, in their life, in their day, in every single moment. That we would acknowledge the presence and the reality of Jesus in our lives. That we would make room for Jesus, for he has made room for us. Let's pray.